Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is freelance tech journalist, Rob Peguero. Rob, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Hey, you are so well-versed in everything. I hardly know where to start.
Well, I try.
It's going to be a fabulous show. Thanks for joining me. You have a very interesting background, but first let me introduce you generally to the audience and the listeners. You are a freelance technical journalist who writes about interesting problems and possibilities for consumer technology. Previously, you were a tech columnist for the Washington Post from 1999 to 2011. And lately, you've written for Yahoo Finance, USA Today, and The Wirecutter, just to name a few. And there's many more. But first, we were talking before the show about your name itself, Peguero, sort of like Martellaro. We're both of Italian descent. How did you tell me about that name? That's very interesting.
So that part of the family comes from a small town called, well, medium-sized town called Vicenza, which is about an hour and change west of Venice on the train. Not quite sure what possessed that part of the family to emigrate to the U.S. around the early part of the 20th century, but for whatever reason, they settled in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, where, as you know, A's kind of tend to get flattened. So when I go to Europe, people address me as Mr. Peguero, and I can't complain. In the U.S., it's Peguero, except when, like, you know, at airport check-in counters, any sort of public event, Gorio,
Gabrando. I'm like, a syllable in there.
You just gotta say it like it's spelled.
Yeah.
The upside is I can get, you know, the first name last name combination is almost always available as a username at any new site.
We Italians have so many vowels in our names that there's so many different ways to pronounce it. It's so cool. So you graduated from Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service, fascinating, in 93 with a degree in international relations, and you didn't take a single course in journalism or computer science. It has not slowed you down a bit.
So, yeah, Georgetown, you know, I do occasionally use that SFS book learning. When I've written about international trade agreements like ACTA, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, I'm like, yes, these are not treaties. They're international agreements. That's why Congress doesn't have to specifically sign off on them. What I did learn at Georgetown, in between going to classes and sleeping and whatnot, I wound up spending a lot of time at one of the two papers on campus, the Georgetown Voice. And by junior year, a lot of time meant 20, 30 hours a week. So since I was doing this without getting course credit or money, you can determine two things. One is I guess I'm easily exploited. The other is I must have liked learning about stuff. And one of the things I learned at The Voice, besides writing quickly and editing quickly, was my freshman year, the other newspaper had a room full of PCs running WordPerfect for DOS. The Voice had a bunch of Macs. And they gradually got better. And so that's where I got my acquaintance with Mac troubleshooting, using ResEdit to play tricks on your colleagues.
Famous ResEdit, yes.
Yeah, battering your way through figuring out how to run Photoshop. Aldus PageMaker, it wasn't Adobe PageMaker then. And when I got to the Post, that was the sort of first non-internship job I had after college. I was working as a copy aide, which, you know, is even less glamorous than what it might sound like. That meant things like sorting mail, running faxes around. On a good day, you can answer the phones. But that put me in a position to be at the paper right about the time they decided we need more coverage of this online world. We need people who can, you know, show us interesting things happening online. And it wasn't that the Post had no one versed in that area. They had a bunch of people, one of whom, John Schwartz, he's still in the business. He writes about science at the New York Times. They all knew their stuff. They also had full-time beats. So here's me with the PowerBook I just spent like $300 to have a 14.4 modem added to. Said, I can write about America Online. Yeah. Or even this local BBS. Sure. And that was sort of how I got my foot in the door.
It won't surprise you to know that you're not the first guest who's told me this story about how they were doing something or other in college and got roped into the newspaper or the yearbook, got caught up in the Macintosh in the laboratory or editing environment and started using all this PageMaker or something like that.
Oh, good.
And then got wrapped up in the technology of the computers, and then they were off and running. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it beats having a real job.
Did you ever have any pangs about your original dream of the Foreign Service, or did you just kind of just quickly move on?
Not really. You know, I'd like to think this has still made me an informed consumer of news about international relations and what's going on, which certainly there has been so much stuff to process for the last 18 months or so.
Yeah.
You know, I like learning about things and telling people what I've learned and maybe learning something more from the subsequent conversation.
That's what we do in this business.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. So then you worked for the Washington Post for a long time and eventually left. Tell me about that departure. That's an interesting story. Nothing.
Yeah, that was the one break in my career I didn't see coming until just a few months prior. This was before Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post, so there wasn't all that money around. But on the other hand, we always thought, well, you know, we're owned by the Graham family. They have an ownership structure that locks out Wall Street. We don't need to worry about quarterly returns. But the buyouts and the resignations kept on coming, and we had fewer people covering technology. And eventually, management of the paper, I'm still not really sure who came up with this idea, decided we don't actually need someone who writes about personal technology specifically. And what I then found is if you want to start freelancing about technology, one thing that at least worked for me, I don't know if this is a reproducible result at all, spend 11 years writing a tech column for a major American newspaper, then leave when people don't expect you to. Suddenly, I had offers coming my way, and I thought, you know what? Let me try this out. I've spent 17 years with the same employer. Maybe I should go in the other direction and not have a single, you know, point of vulnerability in my income.
Is it as profitable as it was before?
Some years it's been more so. You know, it sort of varies on, you know, what sort of rates I've been able to line up, especially the first couple of years. In general, the news business is not as financially rewarding as it used to be. On the other hand, if I'd been set out to maximize my income, then I would have followed the path of a lot of my classmates at Georgetown, which was go on to the law school, become a lawyer, work some crazy hours, and own a lot of suits. Instead, I have just two suits.
Yeah, I had Philip Elmer DeWitt on the show about a year ago, and he talked about how I think he was with Time forever and ever.
Yeah.
And those were the days when you could raise a family and buy a house. On journalism's income.
Yeah. So now I make a pretty good living. I can't complain. There have been months, you know, freelancing means it can vary. You want to have anchor clients that generate about the same amount of income each month. And then you want to be able to be entrepreneurial enough to generate some business on top of that. And one thing I like about this, two things actually, I think y'all empathize with this. At the Post, one thing I would really not like was every time there was some stupid Apple rumor, I'd have to write about it, even if it was dumb, even if I'd addressed it 2 weeks before. People can still ask me to write about stupid Apple rumors, but each extra story I write will involve me getting paid a little more. So it's a little better alignment of work and reward for it. And the other is I can sort of like, you know, self-assign stuff. If I'm interested in a topic and one editor doesn't want it, fine, sell it someplace else. And, you know, it's rewarding because that means you're not, you know, your coverage is not limited by the tastes of one editor.
Yeah, newspapers in this country are under a bit of stress. And do you suspect that they've had to give up the kind of technical expertise in order to survive, and that expertise is posited itself in other places, niche publications that people can focus on, a smaller community of people, sort of like the Mac Observer?
I don't know. I think it depends on the paper. I mean, in general, I see a lot of the same people when I go to various tech conferences and events, and the reporters I meet there all know their stuff. Things can and do get lost in translation. I know I've had one or two times where I've had to tell an editor, please don't publish this because the edit you introduced kind of a large error that's going to make us all look dumb. But I said it more diplomatically than that because I have that, you know, School of Foreign Service education. Mistakes can get introduced that way. You know, the sort of priorities and coverage. I mentioned Apple rumors. That sucks up all the oxygen in the room. Anytime Facebook makes some change and stories get missed when people rush to cover topic A or topic B, and then it's only years later we realize that, you know, oh, hey, you know, this is an interesting topic, but what about this other issue, whether it's, you know, abusive behavior on Twitter, the fact that certain apps are almost designed to enable that kind of misconduct. And you realize we should have, you know, if I had devoted some time to covering this, I would have been way ahead of everybody else.
You said in your bio that, or if I read it correctly, that your family life has improved as a freelancer because of the flexibility of your hours.
Yeah, I work from home, which is good. Like as I speak right now, I have some clothes in the clothesline because it is, you know, reasonably warm and I think partially cloudy. But I can get a lot of chores done because I'm at home. The downside is, you know, I may have to sort of log back on at 10 at night, but that also happened when I work full time. But yeah, like I really appreciate the fact that I have this flexibility and then I can sort of move stuff around and that, you know, I can walk her daughter to her bus stop with my wife. Fortunately, the bus stop is across the street, so this is not a very long journey, but it still counts.
It's an interesting and life takes, when you work
at home. Takes the, yeah, if she takes the bus home early instead of staying for extended day, I can meet her around the corner. That's good. You know, I'm not sure I could survive in an office job now, so let's hope this continues.
One of the things I discovered working out of a home office is that you have to struggle to eat well, believe it or not. The refrigerator is 5 meters away, and yet you still struggle to eat well because of the obsession and being glued to your computer.
Right. Yeah. My home office is upstairs. The fridge is downstairs. There's not a fridge in my home office. There is a lounge chair because sometimes you got to have a nap after lunch. It's easier to do that than to try to fight off the drowsiness.
I got a sense from your bio that you are very Catholic with a small C in your operating system tastes. Because of your broad
yes.
background. Am I reading that right?
As I speak, I'm speaking to you through an iMac, an old iMac with a new hard drive. We can talk about that in a bit.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in the second part of the show.
To its right. Actually, no, I have a Windows laptop, which I thought was to my right, but that's the laptop sleeve. The laptop itself is downstairs. iPad Mini 4 on the desk below me. If any of your listeners have any idea if this will ever see a new iPad Mini,
nope.
Please clue me in.
the answer is no.
Yeah, I was afraid of that. Google Pixel Android phone in my pocket, and I think that's it. I've thought about getting a Chromebook at some point just to have as a sort of backup laptop, but, you know, haven't quite seen the need yet.
How do you feel about Android phones and security?
Right. So I'm kind of stuck as to what my next phone is going to be because I've exclusively bought Google phones since I bought a Nexus 4. I don't know how long ago that was, because the first Android phone I bought got abandoned almost immediately by Sprint and HTC, and it was not a great experience. And so Android, the current version, you know, is a good operating system. I like it. I like the flexibility that it has. I am, you know, satisfied with its security. The problem is that's not the version you get if you get your version of Android through another vendor's customized tweaks. And Google has spent years saying they're going to fix this. And we may actually see some progress on that front. Since last year, they finally got around to providing a hardware abstraction layer, basically separate layer of code that means the people who ship phone chipsets, you know, the radio and whatnot, they don't need to rewrite that code for each new version of Android. They just write to an API, a standard layer, which is sort of basic stuff that's how most things usually work, why Windows is... You know, you can have updates that get installed across a variety of different kinds of hardware. That, if it lives up to its promises, we should see that paying off when the next version of Android ships. And the other problem is, of course, it's hard for the customer to know this. You know, I did a look a while ago. Can you tell if, you know, your wireless carrier is quick at shipping Android updates? And as I recall, two of the big four had actual, like, dashboards where you could see, okay, this is when we ship this particular update, this version of Android. And the other two, there was sort of no accountability, so you couldn't even check that. And so it's not a great scenario. The problem I have with buying another Pixel is, of course, Google decided to follow Apple's very foolish example and get rid of the headphone jack on the Pixel 2, which I think is just a horrible, dumb, and stupid thing to do. And yeah, I'm not sure what to do, honestly. Like, Samsung makes good hardware, but they take Android in all these weird ways and change its configuration in ways that I don't think are helpful. Like, I hardly use Google Assistant. I certainly don't need to have Bixby on this thing, which won't connect to any of the other, you know, apps and tools I use, as well as Google Assistant does. So I don't know. I'm hoping Google will reconsider its headphone jack decision. And in the meantime, that my phone remains intact, that I managed to not drop it anywhere.
Well, you know, I can see how Apple can be in the mood to get rid of wires, to get rid of a way for dirt and water to get into the phone, to make it thinner. We've discussed this ad nauseum in the Mac community.
Yeah.
Kind of feel like, you know, no big deal. I've had an iPhone 7 and then an iPhone 10 here without a headphone jack and haven't missed it. So.
Yeah, I figure, like I said, Samsung does good hardware, and they have certainly figured out a way to have a headphone jack and even, you know, a micro SD card slot, and their phones are still water resistant and dust resistant. So it can be done. It's just a matter of trade-offs. And, you know, yes, I was, you know, when Apple announced the iMac in 1998 or whenever it was, I'm like, that's crazy. They can't get rid of, you know, the floppy disk, the Apple desktop bus
port. What is this USB thing?
Right. I was wrong then. I believe I am right now. I'm afraid, you know, if we're looking at a dwindling share of the smartphone industry agreeing with me, that's a problem.
It's like Fleetwood Mac, never going back again. Well, that's going to have to do it for the first part of the show. In the second half of the show, I want to ask you about some geeky stuff and Google I.O. and some other things. But first, we have to take a commercial break. Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us. I'm chatting with freelance technical journalist Rob Pegoraro. Hi, this is John Marcellera with the Mac Observer. This week, our sponsor is Simple Contacts. If you wear contact lenses and find yourself dreading that annual appointment to renew your prescription, then you're going to love Simple Contacts. This new company makes an annoying process very simple. Simple Contacts lets you renew your expired contact lens prescription and reorder your brand of lenses from your phone or computer in minutes. Simple Contacts brings the doctor's office to wherever you are, whenever you need it. You can take the Simple Contacts vision test online in 5 minutes. A real doctor reviews it and renews your prescription. You save time, money, and save yourself a headache. And if you have an unexpired prescription, just upload a photo of it or your doctor's info and order your lenses in minutes for a great price. All the hard work is done for you. Simple Contacts offers every brand of lenses and their prices are unbeatable. The prescription is just $20. Compare that with an annual appointment, which can be up to $250 without insurance. They have some of the best prices on contacts, and shipping is free. Best of all, listeners here will get $30 off their first Simple Contacts order. Just go to simplecontacts.com/BGM or enter the code BGM at checkout. Note, by the way, that this isn't a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam, but this is the most convenient way to renew a prescription and renew your contacts if your vision has not changed. Again, check out Simple Contacts and get $30 off by going to simplecontacts.com/BGM or just enter the code BGM at checkout. Give it a try. And thanks, Simple Contacts, for being our sponsor. Chatting with Rob Pegoraro, freelance tech journalist. So you wrote in a recent blog that you had been to Google I.O. 2018, the 8th that you've been to.
Yeah, 2010, 12, 13, 14.
Clear that you are into Google pretty much. Tell me about your reaction to the conference overall.
So interesting. Google I.O., you know, there's multiple tracks, there's multiple announcements, and there's sort of varying degrees of relevance. So I think Android P, which I guess is going to be Android Popsicle. It's got to have a dessert name. I can't think of any other pistachio ice cream story.
Or was it? It sounds familiar.
Maybe somebody else has, but they haven't gotten to that letter in the alphabet. Okay, they had
it's always some place to treat.
The E version of Android was Eclair, which I don't even remember when that shipped. Long time ago. Anyways, so that's going to have some good basic security updates to sort of further strengthen things. Like I have, you know, for instance, there's always been this sort of fear people raise. What if the Facebook Messenger app is listening to me? Well, Android P, apps will not have any sort of background access to the camera or microphone. You know, and if they're not updated, they're just going to break.
Finally.
Yeah, exactly. They're adding a lockdown mode where, as I tweeted about this and somebody replied, this is the airport mode where you select this and your biometric unlock becomes disabled. It's only the passcode or passphrase or pass pattern you have no notifications show up on the lock screen, which I think is a good idea because there are certain situations now where you might find that, you know, you're under a certain amount of duress. And if you can say, well, I can't unlock my phone with my fingerprint, that's good. Other stuff going on, you know, the whole...
That goes back to the issue of the law, where there's something right. you are, or your DNA or your fingerprint, or something you can be forced to divulge that you know, like your passcode.
Yes, courts have disagreed on whether or not your fingerprint counts as such. But if the only way to get into a phone is a passcode, a passphrase, or a pattern, that's something you know, it's not saying you are, and you can't be compelled to give that up.
Right.
I mean, if you're... You know, customs wants to search your phone and you're being detained when you want to go home from the airport. It's not like you have complete leverage in that situation. So other stuff at I.O., you know, there's a lot of stuff about Google has a platform, Android Things, which is their attempt to make a more secure Internet of Things by shipping a standardized IoT platform. They're going to guarantee 3 years of software updates. I don't think 3 years is a whole lot for a consumer device like a fridge or whatever that's going to be around for way longer than that. But this is a good ground on which companies can compete. Microsoft has a competing platform they announced, I guess, a week or so before called Azure Sphere that comes with 10 years of security updates and is Linux-based. So, you know, this is not the Microsoft in 1998. That's a good competition to have. On the other hand, you know, the whole demo of using synthesized speech to book a haircut or appointment.
That was next on my list.
Yeah. So at the time, I didn't really think, you know, where did this happen exactly? Because I was too busy transcribing notes. And the one story I knew I would write afterwards was a recap of Android P. Other people then picked up and said, hey, shouldn't you have to say that you're a machine? And thinking about it like I'm... That is one of Isaac Asimov's three laws of robotics, right? A robot can't lie to a human. So
I'm not sure that was one of the laws, but.
Well, first one is definitely you cannot allow harm, cannot cause harm to a human or through
right.
inaction.
Right.
So I got to read up on that again. So I guess we're having a good overdue discussion about AI ethics. So,
well, there was also some critical analysis of the actual demo. I read
right.
some
yes.
commentary about how when a business answers the phone, the business usually doesn't say, hi there. Business usually says,
yeah.
hi, Scotty's hair salon or something like that.
Exactly.
So there was some analysis of that going on.
And yeah,
the more and people dug into it, the more handling. Suspicious people came. What do you think?
Yeah. And you got to be upfront with that. You know, if it was staged, just say so. And it's not a huge deal, but it's just there's this whole mindset throughout the tech industry that if we do something wrong, let's say nothing. When we have to say something, let's offer a background statement that can't be attributed to a single human being. So mm-hmm. there's no one to blame mm-hmm. if they're trying to be an operative. And everyone works that way. Apple is certainly among the more opaque shops when it comes to questions from the press.
Yeah, but when Apple does a demo, there's something there. There's the technology
right.
is reasonably well along. People are starting to get the feeling that there's a whole lot less than meets the eye to Google Duplex.
Yeah, and you know, that's if that product is not as far along as they say it is, I'm fine. That is not really a problem I actually need to be solved.
But it raised some interesting discussions about, like
right.
you said, about being upfront about whether you're a machine or not.
Yeah, because once people start thinking they're talking to a machine, you know, that we have enough stress in our lives. I shouldn't have to think, is this really a human being I'm talking to? You know, at least with a robocall, it's obvious because saying something back to it doesn't change the message at all. It just keeps on playing.
Yeah, but there's that fear that it could be misused, and when it falls into the wrong hands, you get a phone call. It sounds like it's your wife. It sounds
yeah,
like she's asking for
the whole deep fakes thing.
Some information on your credit card because she's at the department store and she needs some information from you. And you so how do you
yeah,
verify?
And one thing that the tech industry has been really bad at historically is thinking about how technology gets misused. The way
yeah.
I like to put it, companies have learned that in the traditional definition of information security, you know, you try to make your stuff break. You hire a red team to test your system to make sure it will not let an unauthorized person gain access. You hire pen testers to try to break in as well. There has been not enough of the same, you know, paranoid thinking applied towards Google or Facebook launches a new video platform. How could it get misused? Apple adds AirDrop. how could that be misused? It turns out that some guys like to send pictures of their anatomy to strangers who they see visible via AirDrop because they can, and because the only way AirDrop works is contacts only or everyone, and you can't even have be temporarily visible to everyone like you're at a conference. It makes me wonder if there were any women who were on the AirDrop team when they were working on that.
Hmm. Interesting. Speaking of security, you wrote an article recently about some big changes at the FTC. I was fascinated by that.
It's so rare where people say, I was fascinated by your story about changes at a government agency that
didn't know existed. is because at the highest level, the shouting matches in Washington, there is one technical direction or appearance of politics, and then you get down to the lower levels where the people are really doing their jobs, whether it's at the FDA or the FTC or the SEC, people are just continuing to do what they're supposed to be doing in general. Yep. And in this case, the FTC seems to be doing it.
Yeah, and it's good that there is that sort of dedication to the mission, and that the Federal Trade Commission now has a full set of commissioners, which it didn't have for years. For a while, it was just two people. Thankfully, they managed to come to an agreement instead of having a lot of one-to-one ties. Because as is, the FTC is going to pick up a lot more responsibility, both because with the FCC handing off, surrendering all of its net neutrality enforcement responsibilities, handing that off to the FTC. That's one thing. The other thing is all these new privacy policies you've seen in the wake of the European Union's new General Data Protection Regulation, the one thing the FTC has always been able to do and has been pretty good at in the past is if a company says it's going to do something in a privacy policy and it doesn't do that, then the FTC has a case because of its deceptive conduct. So, if they have the funding, if they have the people, if they have the time, they could get a lot accomplished. We'll see. The problem is they're budgeted for no more than, their budget has stayed fixed, even though they're getting a lot more work.
That was a cool article. I'll put the link in the show notes. So tell me what you think of the Apple HomePod.
I don't think much about it. I should say I don't have any smart speakers at home. Like the press giveaway at Google I/O was a Google Home Mini, and I'm looking over my shoulder. Yep, still on the floor, still in a shrink wrap. I've not been tempted to buy an Amazon Echo. I already have a computer in my pocket walking around, and it just doesn't appeal to me. And that's, at $100 price for an Echo or a Google Home. $350 for a HomePod that, I can't use with my Android phone that doesn't support Bluetooth, doesn't have line in, no.
That's why I asked you about it, because of your Catholic small C interest in operating systems. I thought you'd be a great unbiased observer of the HomePod.
Yeah, there's lots of stuff from Apple I've been tempted to buy. When they announced the MacBook Pro, I was initially sort of tempted, but then decided, that's a crazy amount of money. And I think I got to look at what is going on the Windows side of the fence. But yeah, the HomePod, I hear it's a great speaker, but, I'm also not an audiophile. And so, there is a market for it, but I am not that market.
To me, truth be told, I don't have one either because it's a lot of money. And I didn't see a problem that it solved for me because I already have a pretty good audio setup. But in the grander picture, it seems to be symptomatic of Apple's difficulties with home automation in the sense that Apple's so focused on its own thing, especially security, that Amazon and Echo are running away with the home automation market, it seems.
Yeah, no, that's definitely the case. And that's one area where it's amazing how rapidly they've advanced. And you can tell Apple is a little anxious because the one time I get an unsolicited, pitch from Apple PR is, each of the last two CESs, right before I head out to Vegas in January, somebody at Apple PR will say, hey, you should check out the HomeKit vendors we have there. And usually their notion of aggressive press outreach is answering the phone on the second ring. So, yeah, and it's too bad because Apple has a good story to sell about privacy and, the fact that they're actually been doing a lot of the things that the GDPR calls on tech companies to do, like data minimization. Don't collect more information than you have to. Instead of the Silicon Valley default, collect it all, Keep it in a database somewhere. This will be useful to us eventually.
My take on the GDPR is that while it applies to the European Union, it's had a salutary effect on American business because a lot of American companies do business over there. And also they want to appear to be doing the right thing in the light of the GDPR. So it's having a kind of a ripple effect, it seems to me, in the United States.
Yep, much more so than I expected. My sense of it when I wrote about it last year and sort of had to struggle to sell the editor on, let me write about this 50,000 word European regulation, that we'd at least get data portability out of services like Instagram and Tumblr that at the time were a one-way road for your data. You could upload your pictures, write your blog posts. You couldn't get them out of there to take to a competing service. Now you can, which alone is very good. Because, it's kind of hard to hold a company accountable when taking your business elsewhere means your entire identity there remains their property. You can't take it with you.
And you can't delete it. You can't expunge your existence.
Yep. Yeah. And it's sort of weird that we've let the EU define U.S. privacy policy.
So we're running out of time, and I only have a few minutes left to ask you about some of the things we were talking about before. And I wanted to ask you about a do-it-yourself project that you told me about. You fixed up an old Mac with an SSD. Tell me about that.
Yeah, this is something I've been meaning to do for a while. I'm speaking to you through a 2009 vintage iMac, which is, it's an antique. And for the most part, it's aged really well. Far better so than any other computer I've owned. But, the hard drive it shipped with was never that fast. And every time this thing has got a page memory out, like when Safari decides that, Twitter's page really should eat up a gig and a half of memory, the whole thing slows down. It's really annoying. What finally got me to do something about it, I've read how-to pieces about you should upgrade your computer from a hard drive to an SSD. First, my backup hard drive, my Time Machine hard drive, failed silently after 7 years. I thought, if the same thing happens to this computer's hard drive, I'm going to be in a lot of trouble. And then I realized that the price of an SSD upgrade kit at Otherworld Computing, a company I've been doing business with since when I owned a Mac clone.
Great company.
Yeah, it was under $200. I'm like, sold. What I didn't realize then
is somehow, was the bus compatible?
So it actually all worked out. The tricky part was basically, although the late 2009 iMac isn't designed to have user accessible parts, it is somewhat accessible. You use two huge suction cups to lift the outer glass out of the thing. It's not glued in place, thank God. And then it's just a matter of disconnecting a series of tiny ribbon cables that look like they're going to rip to shreds the second you tug on them the wrong way, but they actually survived it. And then, the SSD you installed into a mounting bracket. And the other hiccup I had was that, the second screw they had in the box was not the right size. But I live in a fairly nerdy neighborhood, so the second neighbor I checked with had a complete set of Torx screwdriver bits and was able to get that done. The other hangup, of course, was somehow USPS took another week to deliver it after it was supposedly dropped off at my front porch. Still don't know where it happened, but it was very exciting to have it finally appear and not have to wait another 2 weeks for OWC to decide, okay, it's lost, we'll send you a new one.
How's it working out?
Really well. I like it. The computer's so much quieter. You don't hear that thunking, chunking noise of a hard drive paging memory in and out. It launches faster. Software updates, like installing a Mac, the security update Apple just shipped, was not this long proposition to have it written to the drive. Apps launch faster.
Now you can put APFS on it and really be up to date.
Yes, exactly. So it's APFS encrypted. So I've got that going for me as well. So yeah, really glad I did it, in part because it's putting the life into this machine that was otherwise still functional. And in part, it had been a while since I'd done anything like this. So it felt good to, not get some dirt under my fingers. But the cybernetic equivalent of that, that I still hadn't lost it when it comes to monkeying around with circuit boards.
Yeah, the bio photo of you has you wrapped with cables around your neck.
That's great. Cables draped around my neck. I think there's a FireWire cable, USB of various kinds. There isn't USB-C because that wasn't invented when I had that picture taken. I'd like to think there's an Ethernet cable in there. I don't think I was able to find a SCSI cable or anything really old.
That would have been giving you a neck ache. It was so heavy.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we do only have a few minutes left. I can ask you about one more question.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you about your article about 4K and 8K.
Yeah. Man, so 4K TV itself, to me, has always seemed like a product a lot of people do not need because you can't see the extra resolution from the couch. It's like the whole Retina display formula. The idea was not to pack a set number of pixels into a phone screen. It's to make sure you can't see them from a typical viewing distance, not holding it up right in front of your eyes, not looking at it through a photographer's loop. 4K TV at least has since added features like HDR, which gives you brighter colors, wider color gamut. So that's good. But there are people, Sharp introduced this 8K TV at this conference I went to in April. And no, there's no content available in 8K, hardly any. There's not going to be any for a while. You're going to need a screen like 75 inches, which, like, I live in a 1920 house. I can't fit a screen that big pretty much anywhere in the house unless I somehow hang it from a ceiling. There are so many other problems in consumer electronics that need to be solved. 4K being not enough pixels is not one of them. So I'd say, guys, please stop.
Yeah, I think they just do it as a hedge against the future and try to get people jazzed about the technology. And in the process of getting people jazzed about what they're doing and their capabilities, the journalists get jazzed, and then the journalists jump to the conclusion that 8K is the next big thing, all caps.
Yeah.
And it isn't. I don't think 8K is going anywhere either.
I hope you were right. Yeah. I still don't have a 4K set myself because, again, as you can tell, sometimes I'm okay with, you know, old technology that still works.
One of the things I've noticed is that there is issues with compatibility. You know, there's all these different parts and pieces, software updates. You'll see a TV that's 4K it advertised as Dolby Vision, and then you find out it needs a software update to really get to Dolby Vision, and then your Apple TV is on the wrong version of tvOS, and it's not passing it through, even though it tells Netflix that it can absorb it. It's not passing it on, and I went round and round with that on Dolby Vision. I finally got success, and now I have the complete link all the way from Netflix to the badge on Netflix to the Apple TV, absorbing it and putting the badge up and then passing it on to the TV. It was a nightmare. So they got to work that out first.
Wow. Yeah. It does not make me want to. Yep. I'm going to hold on to my measly 1080p TV set for a while longer.
And we're going to have to call it quits because we are absolutely out of time. So this has been a great discussion. Thank you for joining me and sharing me your broad and capable interest in technology. It was great. Thanks.
Thanks.
Tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish to.
So my own blog, my personal site is robpegoraro.com, RobPegoraro. Weirdly enough, Rob Pegoraro is also, you can find me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. I write for Yahoo Finance about a variety of tech policy issues. For USA Today, I do a sort of consumer tech support column. At Wirecutter, I maintain a few different guides to wireless services and gadgets, including cell phone plans and pro tablets. And then check my site to see where else I've written or been quoted in the last few weeks.
All right. Very cool. I'll put some of these in the show notes. Once again, cool. Thank you for joining me on the show.
Thanks.
Folks, you've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you again next week.